Welcome to the Legends Cast. This is a flash cast about Legends of Tomorrow, a show that the Incomparable Network tried once, rejected, and are trying again because we're just so charmed by it. I'm Lisa Schmeiser, and joining me are Tony Sindelar.
Hello, nerds.
And Dan Morin.
Hello, I just flew in from Star City, and boy, are my magically generated wings tired? I don't know.
At least they're not magically generated arms. That would be creepy and weird. But yeah, we did try, remember back in season one, we did try watching Legends of Tomorrow and adding it to our extensive roster of CW superhero flashcasts. And at the time, the show was weirdly airless and kind of joyless and humorless, and everybody peaced out.
You can say bad, Lisa. It's okay. Yeah, you can say it was bad. It was bad.
Okay. But then a funny thing happened to the show, which is it got really stupidly hilarious, like to the point where it ended a season with a giant talking stuffed animal fighting an army of Vikings and and other eldritch creatures. And yeah, that was the climactic season. There was a demon involved. We had Neil McDonough for a whole glorious season. He's like one of my favorite things about the CW verse because he's a great baddie. And enough of us were talking about it. We thought, oh, we'll do a flash cast. So here we are. And Dan, when did you start watching, or did you like grit it through all the way through season one and then discover it got better? Or
I am sad and proud. Is there a word for that? Probably in German. To admit that I watched this.
Sproud, Dan. Sproud. You're Sproud.
I'm Sproud. Thank you, Tony.
Sproud.
I have watched every single episode of this show, even the bad ones. For me, the turning point is...
Dan, that's downright supernatural.
You know what? That's funny, because there's jokes about that later.
Yep.
I don't know why I quite stuck with it. We watched the whole of season one, and it was like, you know what? This is not good. But what I liked about the possibility of the show at the time was that it has a slightly different... It has the ability to shake up its cast a little bit, change the storylines, and there's a lot of variability and possibility with like reconfiguring stuff and doing different types of stories. And around halfway through season two, they went to the white writer's room and went like, you know what? Do whatever. Because at that point,
no one is watching. We may as well just do what we've been joking about doing anyway. So they did.
And honestly, like, that's what sets it apart from the other CW shows, right? Because you've got Arrow, which is like grim and gritty. Flash kind of had that lighthearted element going for it for a while, but it got bogged down in a lot of melodrama. And so Legends sort of decided, well, I'll just be the wacky one because there's no stakes at this point. And it really kind of paid off for them. They mixed up the cast a little bit. They got rid of some of the more dour characters. Hot guy, hot girl. They brought in some really great talent in the form of people like Nick Zano. I don't know him from anything else, but I really like Nate as a character. He adds meta stuff. Him and Ray have great chemistry together. Putting Sarah in charge of the team rather than Rip made a huge difference. And, you know, they did a nice job of building up their roster and deciding, like, let's just swing for the fences and make stuff super wacky rather than trying to tie into, like, you know, they kind of went in the first season being like, let's be this ultimate crossover, a la the way the Marvel movies do crossovers. And that never really worked for them. Instead, it's about, like, let's pick off some, like, you know, perhaps less known people from the DC roster, throw them together, mix them up, and see what we get. And then throw in some just, you know, weird, strange plots. And yeah, it just keeps going from there. So they kind of embraced their weirdness, and it really paid off for them in a big way.
It did. Yeah. No, the kind of the Guardians of the Galaxy vibe almost, in the sense that you have a bunch of people who have been thrown together and have become an incredibly well-functioning group thanks to their complementary dysfunctions.
Well-functioning. Yeah.
Occasionally function.
This is the thing I love about them, is they get the job done. And they're like, yeah, we screwed that up a whole lot, but
they screw things up for the better, as their line was.
They fix most problems, even the ones they themselves may have created and therefore employed themselves. Job security is an essential part of being a time travel agent. You know, you don't want to put yourself out of work.
That's you bring up a good point there, because there's a part in this episode where they're like, oh, you fixed the last of the anomalies in the timeline, and everyone's clapping, and I'm like, why is nobody, like, seen on a computer updating their resumes or whatever?
There's always money in the Time Bureau.
Like, now we're going to send you to parallel universes. So, Tony, when did you start watching Legends resume watching Legends?
I guess I've been there the whole way through. I think at times I waned a little bit in terms of how prompt I was about watching all of them or how much I was paying attention to all of them. But I've been there all the way through. I have some horrible completionist tendencies, and I've stuck with all the DC stuff. I think I probably would have stuck with all the Marvel stuff if not for how many Marvel shows there are out there now, or Marvel adjacent parts, that Marvel properties at least. So I've been there all the way through. I think at times I did let them stack up, and you know, I might be three or four episodes behind, but I have seen it all the way through. I haven't always followed it the most closely, but I do really enjoy, like, I think it took them a while to feel like we can do our own show that's in the same universe, but has a very different tone. And even Flash kind of struggles with that at times, where it feels like perhaps it has to follow too much of the tone of Arrow, or just it's Arrow with science fiction-y elements. So I appreciate that they eventually got away from their and established their own tone. You know, Supergirl is a great example of a show that's set in the same universe, but has a wildly different tone. And it's, you know, you don't need all your shows to have the same look and feel and atmosphere, and still be able to coexist and fight off alien invasions together.
Yeah. When needed, it's easy to have that crossover and bring things together, because that in and of itself is like its own tone, right? The crossover nature, in the same way I think that the MCU does it, is like you can merge a whole bunch of things and say, like, this is just a separate entity in and of itself in some ways.
Yeah, I always feel like the pleasure of a crossover is sort of the same pleasure you had as a kid when you mixed all of the different toys you had together and came up with that giant shared, and then G.I. Joe is going to ride the dinosaur across the Lego Village. It's, you know,
and like, what would Captain Kirk and Optimus Prime talk about when they're having coffee with Batman?
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
So that was
Prime drink coffees?
Matrix
of Power. He has like a fuel tank. Maybe that's where.
And Dan, the answer is they all talk about the burdens of leadership. sorry, I was a very imaginative child.
I was just thinking that that's actually because I think I'm a horrible completionist as well, and so I think I watched Legends of Tomorrow in kind of an let's see kind of way, and then it started getting funny and good and weird, and that was when I was like, oh, this is great. And what I like about it is it picks up a lot of the themes that other CW shows have done well, and it does them well, and it also does them well, but not quite in such a showy way. Like, for example, I think the friendship between Nate and Ray is like one of the sweetest things you'll ever see on TV, and what I love is that they're not cool. Like,
they're extremely uncool.
they're both, but they're like so into it though. They're so into just being themselves, and they're so happy to have someone that gets them. And given that both men are also like very matinee idol handsome, I like that the show has leaned into the dork factor with them. Because I feel like this has actually been a problem in Brandon Routh's career, is he's very handsome and people try to put him in like a tough guy or a Superman type thing, and he's basically a dork.
Well, he's got he's got the John Hamm problem, which is that like nobody that good looking should also be really funny.
Yeah, exactly. But he's a huge dork, and I really love the Ray and Nate stuff that's happened here.
A very non-toxic bromance too, which is really nice. Like, right?
I know,
like
that's the best part. Yeah,
and I mean between that and then you know this season at the end and last season, Sarah and Ava's relationship, which I think is presented really. I mean, especially here in this episode, which we'll talk about a little bit, like it's very healthy, honestly.
Yeah.
Not something you see in a lot of the superhero shows.
The rehabbing of Sarah Lance is like one of the most interesting things that's happened across the CW verse as a whole.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, we first got introduced to her in Arrow, where she's like the feckless younger sister of Laurel, and she doesn't care that she's boffing her sister's boyfriend, and meh, who cares? And then she's an assassin, and she's all grimdark and death, and meh, who cares? And then over the course of Legends of Tomorrow, she's been allowed to grow into somebody who owns her past and takes responsibility for it, but doesn't let it define her. And she's developed a, like a, she's become like a real leader, like where she's genuinely concerned about developing other people's skills and bringing out the best in them. And she's concerned about their welfare. For example, there's like a little throwaway moment in this episode where Ava's like, oh, you want to stay? And she's like, I got to get back to the ship. My guys aren't used to not being on shore leave. And it's just the fact that she's already mentally like, what has Rory done? And I thought yeah. Sarah Lance.
Whose turn is it to watch him?
Yes. Yeah.
There's a chore wheel.
There's a chore wheel, and I guarantee you, Rory has set it on fire. But like the fact is, she wouldn't have done that a couple of seasons ago. She would have been resentful about these clowns and angry about the whole situation. And it's like her transformation has just been so graceful in a way. It's just been really understated and graceful. And Katie Lotz has done a really great job playing it. So I think that's another thing I like about the show is characters have been allowed to grow and change and become better versions of themselves. And it's nice to see that happening in a storyline. You know?
Yeah.
I liked in this first episode of season four. They're pretty light on the use of powers, and it's a lot of basically just people kind of bouncing off each other and wacky adventures more than it is figuring out what combination of our superpowers do we need to save the day.
I think that's something they've leaned into even in the last season too. I mean, certainly they don't shy away from the use of the powers where it makes sense, but they use them in ways that are orthogonal to just like beat up the bad guy with my stronger powers, right? Like in this episode, like, we have Ray.
We see them in the montage.
Yeah. Ray shrinks down to steal a hair from someone, from right?
Janis Joplin, the Adam suit. It's so sweet. This actually, like, I don't know about you guys. I got a little lost with all the totem stuff last year. Like, after a while, it was like, okay, do I have to keep a chart of who has what totem in what order? And so I'm kind of relieved that they wiped that off the map. And now we basically have our team, which, We've got our dork bros, and I mean that in the most affectionate way possible. We've got Rory, we've got Zari, and we've got Sarah. Who else am I missing?
I think that's it right now. We've lost right Wally has them. Gone off.
To like find himself.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. So one of the other things I really like about they leaned into in this, even in the season opener, is just, you know, the kind of meta awareness, right? Yes. Like we're talking about, you know, Ray talks about the ratings and how to improve the ratings in the Time Bureau, of course. You know, and they make a comment about how Wally has gone off to find himself. Didn't he do that last year? Like And so, yeah, we've kind of pared down a bit at the beginning of the season by shaking up the crew a little bit, as we always do. Yeah. So
Amaya.
Vixen. Amaya, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but so we may have lost those two, but I think we're up a wizard if John
Counts. At least he's in you know, his application is under review, right?
Yeah. So I gotta say, I actually watched Constantine when it was on.
I watched most of it. I didn't finish it, but I've seen most of it.
Yeah.
You got the idea.
I mean, I love my assessment of that show, as in so many other shows I've seen, is Matt Ryan is fantastic. This show the casting is garbage. Was great. hot garbage, but he is really good, and I'm delighted that they managed to salvage him and brought him over to Arrow first and then Legends last year as a recurring character. And so frankly, I can't get enough. I'm all in on Matt Ryan's John Constantine. I love it.
Yeah, so we have what looks like five carryovers from last year with Legends. It looks like we're bringing in the Time Bureau as regulars this year. Well, if not regulars, regularly recurring characters. And then John Constantine is kind of your utility player to be determined later. Do we want to recap what happened in this episode? I assume people who are listening to a flash cast have probably also watched the episode, but the purpose to recap is to get us all on the same page where we're like, here, we agreed this happened, and here's what stood out for us, right?
Sure. Yeah. I you want me to do a flash cast style recap?
Yeah.
I'm not prepared, but I think I can do it. I think I still got it in me, Lisa. It's been a while since we did a flash cast.
Are you stretching? Are you jogging in place?
Get the Speed Force something.
I don't know. Dan, this is your chance to step in and say, no, we want to do it Arrow style.
No. The guys, there's a whole sort of trademark issue. I don't want to infringe on anything. Right. So, Tony.
All right. Well, Dan, you prepared to do a cleanup for the details that get lost in the Flash.
I'm ready. I'm here.
Flash style.
There we go. All right.
All right. So, as already mentioned, the season starts off with basically them celebrating that they fixed all the timeline, I guess, between season three and season four. Everything's great, but they're still worried because John Constantine has warned them that there's magic monsters out there that they need to deal with. And indeed, the first subtle disruption to the timeline they discover is that Woodstock is now known as a massacre, and in perhaps one of my favorite things so far in Legends for leaning into the goofiness, the massacre is caused by a murderous unicorn. The other kind of plot threads we've got is that Rey is still looking for Nora Dark, who has apparently escaped from the Time Bureau. I don't totally remember the nature of the relationship with how things shook out at the end of last season. Sarah is leaning hard into trying to recruit John Constantine to join the team officially, and he will, you know, it looks like they've vanquished the demons and the evil at the end, but John Constantine gets, you know, shaken up in his apartment by an unseen force. And also, I guess, Sarah's relationship with the lady in charge of the Time Bureau is advancing.
And so, we also have a Nate's somewhat tortured relationship his father. Yeah.
With his father, yes.
Thomas Wilson, a.k.a. Biff Tannen.
Yes.
I would.
That's beautiful casting. I really appreciate that casting.
I will say, speaking of stunt casting, so the funny thing, of course, is that the actress who plays Nora Dark is actually married to Brandon Routh.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, so that there's a reason. I think we're leaning hard into a romance subplot
there. So remind me... what happened with Totems and Nora Dark? I remember that, you know, she thought she was kind of being part of her father's plans, but then perhaps had been
swapped in for more
part as an ingredient than as a partner, I guess.
I feel like you've put your finger on the fundamental essence of that plot line.
Yeah. So is she a supervillain, or was she just is she related to a supervillain?
Interesting situation too, because this is also a character that first appeared in Arrow as a small child and has basically, so I think this is a future version of the character, or a character who aged throughout time, and so we had her as that recurring villain, but we also had like the sort of glimmer of redemption in it. And of course we have Rey, who is literally a Boy Scout or an Eagle Scout, as we learned in this episode. Tony, I thought you find some kinship there.
Oh, that's been mentioned several times throughout the series.
Yeah, like
that's a certain kind of nerd that
he is the embodiment and paragon of that, right? Like, so he believes that there's good.
He's got his compass.
People want a second chance, and he's determined to give her a second chance.
No, he's lawful good to an extreme.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. That's, again, you've put your finger on it, which is basically Rey believes in redemption and Rey believes in Nora, and Nora's a nihilist. So obviously they have a lot in common. But yeah, I think that Nora being, I think Nora's going to be your wild card for the whole season. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that we'll see that play out, and they'll continue to hunt down weird stuff like unicorns that shoot hallucinogenic goop at people.
Yep.
Because that was my favorite part of how the unicorn defended itself is when Rory went after it with the flamethrower, and it shot them with the goop, and then they all hallucinated big time. And there was a really sweet scene there where Nate hallucinates his dad and has a heart-to-heart conversation with him, but it turns out he's having a heart-to-heart conversation with Rory, who is hallucinating his dead rat.
I'm so glad we saved Axel.
Yes, and so what happens is, you know, when Rory is hallucinating, Nate is saying, "I love you, I really love you." And Rory's like, "It's my rat. My rat has come back from the dead to tell me he loves me," and he hugs him. And it's just such a hilarious.
I do have to say, and this is, you know, apropos of the composition of the team, certainly losing Captain Cold was a blow, and it's great whenever Wentworth Miller pops back in to reprise that role. But they've really given themselves some room to develop Rory, who is a character that is very, you know, he is a one-note character in what he does, but they've had a chance to explore different aspects of him, and they certainly haven't redeemed him, really. Mm-hmm.
Like, I believe him hanging around on his own a lot more than I believe Captain Cold hanging around, right?
Exactly.
I think Rory hangs around with them. I think Rory hangs around with them on his own because he actually gets to do crime, and they turn a blind eye to it. And they watch his back.
He's a follower, right? I mean, he needs a strong personality with a plan to latch on to.
And he's developed a rapport with both Rey and Nate, among others.
Yes, like, and Sarah.
Yeah. So like you have, and even Z to a certain extent, like you have them all. They do a nice job of interleaving these characters and making it believable that they would have a relationship, even though they are so wildly different.
Well, I also appreciate that the relationships are all different, because it's not like they all have the same type of relationship with each other. You can tell there are different degrees of closeness and different degrees of respect. My favorite episode from last year was the one where Zari was caught in the time loop, thanks to Gideon.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, she had to keep trying to figure out ways to save everybody. And that's when she discovers that Rory is writing a romance novel. And I loved that detail. I loved it so much, especially then when she's like, keep doing it. It's really good. And he's all, ugh. But yeah, like you said, he's a follower. I find his character also really interesting, because he's been kind of developed over the course of the season you know? I mean, you've got a guy who has made it really clear he has no interest in revisiting trauma whatsoever. He doesn't want to really engage with anybody who he's not sharing a spaceship with. I do also find it deeply hilarious that when he steps inside Nate's house, the first thing he does is steal a candlestick.
My favorite bit from that was the line where his mom asked, Mr. Murray, do you like sandwiches? You bet your ass, ma'am. It's like the perfect encapsulation of that character right there.
Yes. Well, because it's both crude and polite.
Yes.
Yeah, right?
It's what I also appreciate was the way you get reintroduced to him in this episode is, I hate British people. And Nate is like, the Beatles led to the Rolling Stones, who led to Black Sabbath. He's like, Black Sabbath, let's protect them. And I appreciate that Nick has figured out how to press different. Nick has figured out how to lead Rory to the conclusion that he wants. Nate has figured out how to lead him to the conclusion he wants him to have, too. So I appreciate that they've all learned how to handle him.
Right. Exactly.
Yes. Like an animal that he's, you know, that they need to employ.
They must have like read some zookeeper training books. Yeah. I think I would suspect that Gideon was probably like, I recommend you read this memoir of a zookeeper and learn how to reinforce behavior. And they're like, oh, good idea. One of the things I have kind of mixed feelings about is poor Gary in this episode. Because on the one hand, I appreciate him as comic relief. On the other hand,
I didn't think he was going to actually get hurt. He did have like his arm inside a unicorn mouth is depicted as very teethy.
I thought he was going to come off with one hand or something. I was like, that was going to be pretty dark.
Also, Dan, it's not just that your hand is gone. Your hand has gone to hell. That's bad.
I mean, I guess.
Because, like, what if the hand
can you get a soul hand later? How does it? There's a lot of implications, Dan.
Yeah, there's the theological implications alone are staggering. Prosthetics-wise, you have to exercise the prosthetic on a regular basis to make sure it's not possessed by fell forces from beyond.
I do enjoy Gary's relationship with Constantine, which has, you know, been hinted at a couple different places, especially because last season they played D&D together at one point.
Yeah.
So I enjoy that, and I like I also like that, you know, this is unlike on the Constantine show where I think they shied away from some of the traditional hallmarks of this character, for example the smoking and the sexuality of the character, whereas here they just embrace that wholeheartedly.
Well,
I thought last year they did have a couple scenes with him with the cigarettes. I thought they did show.
I think he's had them like tucked behind his ear or in his mouth, but I think
they do a lot to fake it up. I think there's like standards reasons why you don't do that. I mean, for example, in this intro, he's totally about to light a cigarette, and Sarah, you know, grabs it out of his hand, right?
Yeah.
So they're going a lot closer to that line.
As carefully as there's probably someone from Standards and Practices who's standing over the monitor at some point. But no, they've leaned into it, which is nice, because I think that's actually one of the greatest things about the comic book character is the fact that he's like, oh, boundaries are completely arbitrary and they're usually erased by magic anyway. So meh, and off he goes there. I like the Sarah Ava relationship a lot in this episode too, and I was on the floor laughing with the here I go hitching the U-Haul to the Subaru. I was like,
that's a great line too.
But
I like that, and I like Sarah espousing her love of her fuzzy slippers, which is a very again, like you said, Lisa, the evolution of Sarah as a character. Sarah from Arrow or Sarah from the first season of Legends of Tomorrow would not have been caught dead in fuzzy slippers.
Well, I don't think Ra's al Ghul would have been cool with him, you know. I mean, literally,
as
none of
not
that
League of Assassins code.
No, no, they probably all had like grim leather slippers with studs.
They just have dirty feet.
God. Yeah, because I'm pretty sure it's a shoes off type of fortress. But
yeah. Well, like you got to be. It's like your footsteps are quieter that way or something.
Yeah,
but the soles of your feet are just heavily calloused.
Yeah. So it's I feel good about the start of the season though, because they've like. Whoever's in the costuming department for Legends of Tomorrow, this is either the best job they've ever had or every week is a fresh hell, depending on like what time periods they go to. But the Woodstock stuff was fantastic.
Yeah. The production value has also, I think, ramped up a little bit over the last season. I mean, yes, you're always going to cheat it a little bit in this way. Woodstock, you know, it's a big field with a lot of people in it. That's pretty easy.
I was surprised really when carefully. They had one shot of a CGI crowd in the distance. Cause I was like, okay, I did not expect there would be, I thought we were going to see Woodstock with 12 people. I also, you know, and it's Woodstock with, guess what, there's some woods near it. Woods, it's in the name. Yeah. And we're gonna do a bunch of stuff in the woods away from the crowd, so we don't have to have a crowd the whole time.
That said, the special effects on the unicorn were surprisingly good.
And the unicorn creepy, having its flesh stripped away.
The creepy unicorn, also really good.
The creepy unicorn was really startling. I was all, oh my god.
They've definitely put a little more time and effort into doing the production values of that kind of stuff too. So I appreciate that. It's a nice like, you know, there's a lot, it's great to have the Wave Rider, and you've got a lot of sets on there that you can use. But you know, this is a show about time travel, and you know, you should kind of embrace that. Like, no one goes to time travel to just go to like Office Parks in various centuries.
And it's, you know, it's hard in the other shows. I feel like basically every exterior shot, it's clearly like not just the woods in Vancouver, but like the same woods. Same woods. Like, which we also need to believe is an island in the South China Sea.
This is how they stretch the budget across the CW. Is they're like, here is our beach. It's basically stock footage. You can do this clip, or this clip. Pick one.
I also thought this episode did something. It's always notable to me when superhero shows mix stuff up a little bit, because cinematography wise, and this one they have the weird split screen shot when all the legends come in,
that
which I liked. I thought that was cool. It was different. That is not a thing that they do a lot in these shows, is play around with the cinematography.
So you know what it kind of reminded me of is you're all compulsive completists too. Ang Lee's The Hulk.
Yes. Yep.
When he
the comic book style.
The comic book style there. And I appreciated it there. That's one of the things about the movie I did appreciate. And I liked it here too, because it was such a dynamic way to depict all this stuff going on and to show the collision. And then when you see them all run into each other and the lines drop completely, it was just a really nice arc within an arc, like a visual arc that served the story as well.
Yeah.
So
I love that it ends with them all high fiving because they're all in the same place.
They're doing their dork dance and it's just great. So I have high hopes for this season. I think Nora Dark's going to be like your wild card that pops up to keep things from getting to standard Unicorn of the Week, but I think you are going to have Unicorn of the Week. If I had to make a guess based on what I saw in the last few minutes of the episode, where Constantine is having a very bad time in his apartment and this message gets drawn on blood in his mirror that's all, "We'll get you, John Constantine," he might do something dumb like say, "Let's go time travel," because he'll be under the theory that the more he hops around, the more he can confuse whatever's after him. I think that's how they're going to get him on the Wave Rider.
Either that, or there is, I don't know, maybe there's something chasing him that wants him to be on the Wave Rider.
So I'm curious, we've seen a kind of a sizzle reel trailer of what's coming this season, but it seems like we're probably going to have a variety of supernatural monster type creatures. Are there any things that you would like to see that, or maybe that you know that you'll see that you're looking forward to in terms of what's on your monster bucket list, Dan?
I don't know on the monster bucket list, but I do think that there was a clip in the sizzle reel where they're all dressed up as camp counselors, including Constantine, which I'm like, I'm totally there for that. There for that.
So they're gonna get perhaps killed by some kind
like
of
slasher
hockey
or something
mask
like that. So
I'm a little unclear on what the because they're magical monsters, right? I mean, Constantine like killed a dragon off scene, and there's a unicorn. Dragons and unicorns don't come from hell? He asks.
Well,
but the unicorn was pretty hellish looking after a while.
I mean, it went there, but yeah. Did it come from there?
I mean, there's no rule saying you have to return it exactly where
maybe
you found it.
Maybe hell could be like Atlanta Airport, where everything that passes through it comes
out. So, like, a slasher from a horror movie is, you know, that doesn't live anywhere per se, but it's been conjured into existence by magical forces. So
yeah, right,
exactly. or it's like a creature from the Black Lagoon type thing. Or what is it? It's like the Loch Ness monster. Oh, Champy in Lake Champlain. There was a thing for a while where Lake Champlain allegedly
Lisa, let me tell you, almost every lake has a famous lake monster. Turns out. Fish look weird from a distance.
Apparently so. Or otters can freak
people. Otters swimming in a line. Yeah,
otters on top of fish.
I was pretty excited about seeing them dressed as pilgrims or Puritans.
Is there a famous Thanksgiving monster that I'm unaware of?
Yes, the turkey monster.
Well, no, there's the Salem Witch Trials, though.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I think we're going to get an episode about that.
Okay.
And it will probably. And I'm just also trying to imagine Rory listening to "Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God," so and going for that. But I'm excited. I only watched The Sizzle Reel part once. My DVR got really weird, and I missed like half of it, so I only saw like the Puritan stuff. But definitely excited, and I think it's only a 16 episode season, isn't it?
Yeah, which I like. I like these shows that pare down a little bit. One of the best things I think you could say about Iron Fist Season 2 is that it was 10 episodes.
Oh, my gosh. And an even better thing is, like, the first four are completely unnecessary.
Yeah, so I honestly think that the economy, right, is important.
Yeah.
You know, you guys covered Flash seasons before. I covered the Arrow seasons, and, like, 23 episodes is a lot of episodes.
It's a lot of episodes.
So
and there's always, like, a furniture
still
moving
seems
episode.
Like a lot, but, like, it's, like, a third less. So that's pretty great.
And I think we know that they've said that the Legends is not part of the crossover event.
Yes,
that's
correct. They are apparently doing their, what I've seen is them saying they're doing their own crossover that week, where they cross over with themselves.
What?
Oh, I can't wait to see how that
works.
What
does that mean, Dan?
I think kind of like, so in the last season where we had the episode where they had to save themselves from like the previous incarnation. So I think they're going to be crossing over with themselves from maybe some of their previous adventures.
Okay.
Which seems clever and amusing. So I'm down for that. Back to the Future 2 style, sneaking around maybe, trying to like save yourselves. But they staying out of the larger crossover, I think, is great for that crossover and for Legends themselves. So, like, it's good that you can bring them in and out.
I enjoyed the mega crossover last year with like a cast of like 40 heroes, but like I feel like they can do that once and then they don't need to do that again. Yeah. Doing that every time is unnecessary. That's a lot of baggage, a lot of capes to pack.
The logistics alone for filming that thing have to be a nightmare.
Yes.
And then asking four separate writers' rooms to come up with a way to make it plausible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
or else you're in a position where, like, oh, we're going to take this episode and it completely does not advance the interest of the rest of your season, but synergy. And
but
like, oh,
these days,
thanks.
Now that they've kind of like always marked off that 1 week of the year as we're going to do the crossover, I think they're much more prepared for it. To be able to say, like, we're going to blip out this week and we're not really going to deal with any of the ongoing plot stuff from any of the shows. Like, just treat this as a event. And we go in and we do it. We come back and we reestablish the status quo, right? So that's nice because it's tricky, too. I mean, over on Arrow, especially, you're dealing with a situation where, you know, your main character is not in their usual situation. So finding a way to deal with that is tricky. And, you know, I think that's the Legends in some ways are the most versatile of the crew because you can kind of put them anywhere. And there's always kind of a reason or an explanation for them to be there. It's nice to not have to do that every time.
Yeah. This actually reminds me, one of the other things I really liked about this week's Legends of Tomorrow was the scene between Zari and Rey, where she and Rey watch her mother. And her mother is pushing a very young Zari on a swing. And Zari talks about how every day she feels guilty over not being able to save her family, but she knows that she can't do it. And what I appreciate is that the writers and the show has put the hard limit on, no, you don't get to rewrite the past. You don't get to change things for your own benefit. You know, you have this ability to fix time, but you can't exploit it. And I like that they do that up front.
Mm-hmm. Especially, I felt like they had not really revisited the idea that, like, it is significant that this one character is from a somewhat different part of the timeline, as opposed to people that we've grabbed you from 100 years in the past. Like, she's from 30 years in the future. Like, that's a little strange, and especially because it seems like 2018 is kind of their home. Like, that's where the party is, right? So
that said, it's really unsettling when you think about it. Yes. How you've got this Muslim woman who's pushing her daughter on a swing in what looks like a perfectly normal America 2018, and then you think about the America we were introduced to with the episode that brought Zari on board,
and then you think about our actual 2018.
Exactly. And I was like, I had a lot of feelings, putting it mildly. And this is another thing I'll be super curious, because the CW shows, well, actually, I take that back, because Supergirl this year is bringing a lot of messaging to it. But the CW shows, by and large, tend to be more about ideals than about explicit policy statements. But yeah. I'm curious to see how Legends of Tomorrow is going to handle some did the thing that we see with Zari, where, you know, she asks Ray, she's like, how can anyone be afraid of this woman? Look at her. And I'm wondering if we're going to see that sort of theme play out over the season too, because I feel like in many ways the first episode of a season pretty much sets the table for what's going to happen. Yeah. We're gonna find out that friendships are still going strong. Rory is still reliably Rory. Sarah's a really good leader, and what's more, she's also trying to be a really good partner because she confesses to Ava at the end of the episode. We're gonna find out that there's lots of magical creatures they have to deal with. There is a rogue Nora Dark.
Something's haunting John Constantine.
And Nate's going to deal with his family, or try to anyway. And then the question is, will the question that Zari has, which is, how do you do this to people? Like, is that going to inform her story for the season? Or is that a question that we're going to get asked every week?
Yeah, I think, I think that's a good question. Yeah, you put it really well, Lisa. Like, we've seen interesting questions raised for all of these characters, all of our main characters. And so how are we going to continue to explore those for the rest of the season? Because these don't tend to be things that we ask. And they're like, well, glad I asked that question. Moving on to something else.
Yeah, exactly. So let's get Rory a rat. Oh, my God. I appreciated that he did hallucinate the rat and not Captain Cold, although that would have been kind of hilarious at Woodstock, let's admit it.
Yeah, I thought it might be, but then I was delighted to see that it was the rat.
Not just a rat, but a giant CGI rat.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And he's like totally fine with it. He's just so happy to see his little ratty friend again. He's
also, I do special props to Brandon Routh again for the scene where Constantine and Sarah happen upon the group all tripping out, and Brandon Routh
he's making out with a tree. Yep. Dan, he's an Eagle Scout. It's what you do.
What happens in the Eagle Scout stays in the Eagle Scout, Tony.
I thought that was part of the Order of the Arrow, not the Eagle Scouts. Oh, no. Oh, no, I do love... Well, yeah, because when he was originally hired on in Arrow, and you see him, and he's supposed to be this foil to Oliver, and you're like, who will Felicity pick? Whither shall her heart fly? And you're like, oh, my God, there's no contest. Like, you know, he's not bent enough for her. And I just really like, again, that they've made him the most... like you said, lawful good. They've made him just the most intensely lawful good and 100% comfortable with that version of himself. I think it's the greatest thing you could do for a character like that, like somebody who like leans into sincerity and leans into all his qualities, and it's like, yeah, this is me, I'm here for it.
Yeah, I do enjoy his relationship with Rory too, that they have struck up this weird friendship, because it's I mean, and that dates back to like season one. That was one of the brighter spots of season one, was that they started to like try and explore, well, how do we deal with this character, these two characters sharing this space together. And they've kind of carried that through as a through line, and I'm impressed, because it really works. And part of it, a lot of it comes down to the charm of those two actors and knowing and having chemistry. But those characters, I really enjoy them paired together.
Yeah, Rory and he's a dork, but he's my dork. So
right, and I mean, he's lawful good. You got lawful good and chaotic evil, neutral, chaotic neutral, somewhere in there.
I think, but just like, neutral. Yeah, chaotic neutral. Like,
yeah,
you know, I was a little surprised when he stole the car, because I was like, really? Okay. I guess that's what we do.
Or
now.
That Nate went with him, which was also a little strange. But yeah, whatever. Yeah.
But I mean, we find out Nate's working through some stuff. Again, it's like, you know, his dad's, why are you here? And he's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
The script told me to come here.
Yeah, no, it's, I like that he said that, where he's, I don't know.
Yeah.
I have feelings to work out. And, yeah.
And as Tony hinted at earlier, I really enjoyed the joke about how the people really like the supernatural.
Yes. Hey, I thought of you, Dan. I thought
of you, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They got to do it. So I think we have pretty much put a pin in it for this Flash cast. And I want to thank you both for participating. Our goal is to try to get one out within 3 or 4 days after each episode. It's a Flash cast, not an Instacast. And let me wrap it up. I was Lisa Schmeiser, and with me were Dan Morin.
Thanks for having me.
And Tony Sindelar.
Goodbye, nerds.